This is Phil Ferrand. And I am driving home. It's Thursday today. This is episode 6. 627? I think 627. I think. 626, 627, 628. I don't know. Whatever it says on the title. That's what it is. All is well. It's been a good week at work. So that's all going fine. We're just puttering along. Had some meetings today. Good meetings. Had meetings earlier in the week. Good meetings. So all is well. All is well with the writing. I'm just distributing the last of the beta books at this point for book 14. And so we'll get the beta readers reading that. I think it'll be fine. There's one scene right towards the end of the book, but it's there for a reason. I'm trying to show people how deadly the flesh can be if you decide to listen to it. So, you know, it's pretty dramatic. I think it's okay. It probably will be okay. But it really shows how ridiculous the flesh can get and how destructive it can be. And the problem is as soon as that gets in place and starts working, it just bleeds out everywhere in your life. And it just gets worse and worse and worse. So I think it's important to talk about, and I think it's essential for men especially. I decided to put it in because I felt like it was important. But it'll be fine. That'll be fine. I'm started with book 15. That's going fine. Fine so far. I like where it is. It's really interesting how things kind of fit together. At the end of one of those 44 hour fasts. I kind of knew what the structure was, and so I needed some sort of preliminary mission on the front, and I didn't really know what that was, but I knew I kind of wanted it to chew up, you know, somewhere around 200, 250 pages or so at the front, and then I wanted to get on to the second half of the book, and so. But I didn't really know what it was, but I had this thought that I should base it on a documentary that I had seen about some of the royal courts in England and the behaviors there. And then a couple of weeks ago, we talked about Dhaka Muslin. And so I kind of did a takeoff on that as well. And it always amazes me that things are foggy and you're kind of in the dark and you don't know where you're going, and then you just put your fingers in motion and one thing leads to another, leads to another, leads to another, and it just starts cascading. So that's always interesting. It's very, very interesting. So that'll be fine. And it seems to be going well. There's one section I'm not entirely comfortable with yet that I wrote this week because it's a lot of flashback, but it's right at the beginning and it's needed because it's filling in the gaps between this book and the last book, and there's a year. And so it's, you know, the first part of the book, you're always just trying to get people caught back up to speed as to what's going on, and you're having to account for the fact that maybe this is a completely new person who's coming in. And so I usually go a little heavy on explanation in the first three or four chapters to try to make people aware of the things they may not be aware of because they haven't read the other over a dozen books. So I have one new beta reader this time, and one who's kind of returning, So, you know, I always tell them there's a lot of pages that went before this one, so expect to be confused a little bit, but hopefully things will settle down. And, you know, it's always the case when I start scanning through the book that I think, oh, okay, that could be phrased a little bit different. That could be phrased a little bit different. So these books are definitely not an example of my best work. But the ideas are there, and this is just a writing exercise for me. It's just to write a lot, a lot, a lot. So, you know, that's fine. And I enjoy them, and I mean, so far, my longtime beta readers seem to be enjoying them and seem to find things that intrigue them in them, and so, yay. So we're going along. Once I get, I've said this before, but it's exciting for me. Once I get book 15 roughed in, I am in the single digits. I only have 9 more books to go. So, and I already know what book 16, the big thing of book 16 is, which I've got to wrap some other stuff around it. And then we're 2/3 of the way. And then we're into the final 8. So... and that's when things just kind of go crazy. So anyways, I do need to drop off a book to one of my beta readers, so I'm going to pause this for a moment. I'll be right back. Okay, I'm back. Dropped off a book. But I'm backing up now, so I got to kind of concentrate on backing up so I don't drive off the road. Anyways, so it's really interesting to watch how things develop, because... you start in one place, and I thought, oh yeah, oh yeah. And as I write, then it starts developing. Then I figure out what's happening in that scene. You know, then I figure out who's involved. Then I figure out where people are. Then I figure out, it's like, oh, okay, that's what's going on. Oh yeah, okay, that's what's going on. And then all of a sudden, it's just like goes and just inflates, and ta-da, you know. So that's always a really, really interesting thing when that happens. And I may have just missed my turn, because I may have just missed my turn. I think I did miss my turn. The roads out here in the country, they go weird directions, and because it's all depending on who owned what property, and you know, so now I am turning to the right when I really want to be going left, but eventually we'll get home. So anyways, yes, I just missed the turn that I was supposed to take, but we'll figure it out. It'll be fine. Anyway, so that started. I'm on chapter, just about getting ready to start chapter 3, which means I'm 16,000, 17,000 words in, 16,000, something like that. And so tonight is 500 words, and then 1,500 tomorrow, and then 2,500 on Saturday. Tomorrow's going to be a bit of a push, because I have a couple of appointments, and I basically get home, change, turn around, head back in. It's going to be cute tomorrow, because tomorrow is National Unicorn Day, which I already have a unicorn outfit that I just dearly love. It's one of those inflatable outfits, and I just dearly love this outfit. So since it's National Unicorn Day, and it's a unicorn outfit, we're doing it. But I was also going to see my dentist tomorrow get my teeth cleaned. And the problem is the inflatable costumes, I can't lay there with it inflated, so I've got to turn off the fan, which means that all the plastic comes and wraps me in, and so I would be sitting there in a plastic bag getting my teeth cleaned, and of course that's not going to work. So I'm, instead of doing that, I'm going to put the Tooth Fairy costume back on and head down to see my dentist, because when I did National Tooth Fairy Day, I had already planned to do this, but one of the people who reacted on Facebook said, you know, you should really wear that when you go to the dentist. They'd love that. I wrote back and I said, I'm already planning to do that. I said, I've got a dentist appointment coming up here in a couple of weeks, and it is on the schedule, so they like that. However, I lost my glasses. It's been about 2 weeks now. I did have a backup pair, which is good. It has masking tape and stuff around it. It's not great, but I'm just using it to, you know, to drive with, so it's fine. So I had had an eye appointment a couple of years ago, and so I called them and said, hey, can I get my prescription? Because I would really like to just order some glasses. And they looked it up and they said, well, it was 2019 and you really need to come in. You need to come in for another appointment. So I said, oh, that's fine. So I was going to be heading south anyways tomorrow. And I said, you know, I'm going to be heading south anyways. So will Friday work? So they found an appointment for me at 1:30 on Friday. And I said, now this was, I had called them on April 1st. So I said, fair warning, I am going to be coming down in a Tooth Fairy costume. And the lady said, what? I'm going to my dentist right afterwards. And I said, I am a celebrant of obscure holidays. I'm going to my dentist. I have a Tooth Fairy costume. I'm wearing it because they're going to get a kick out of it. So I said, I'm just trying to keep you informed. And the lady on the other side kind of paused and she said, are you pranking me? Is this like April Fool's? I said, no, it is not. It is not April Fool's. I actually am going to be coming down there in a Tooth Fairy costume. Okay. So, yeah. So this will be fun. You know, so we'll see how this goes. But I expect that my dentist is going to get a big kick out of the Tooth Fairy costume. They called to remind me today I had an appointment tomorrow. And the guy on the other end said, and we are aware that it is National Unicorn Day, because they know the shtick now. So they go and they look on the website. We are aware that it's National Unicorn Day. So, you know, if you wanted to come down here with the, you know, riding a unicorn, that would be fine. So I called back and I said, well, I do have a unicorn costume. I am going to Walmart tomorrow with it, but I said, it's just like a big plastic bag, but I got something else for you. I've got something else. I'm coming out. Okay, good. So, because apparently the women in the office remind him to remind me that it's fine if I want to come down in a costume. So, you know, people enjoy it. They enjoy it. It's fine. Speaking of costumes, I have been working along on the Talk Like Shakespeare Day costume. I think I'm on schedule for it. Boy, I've worked this whole week just on the doublet or doublet, whatever they call it, just the chest coat. But I'm close on that. It's gonna be fine, and everything gets easier after that one. I still have a number of pieces that I have to get put together, but I think I'm okay. Time-wise. So I'll try to make some good progress on that this weekend. So that's 2 weeks from tomorrow. I did order my cards. I ordered some cards that were like 3¾ inches wide and 8¼ inches tall. There's like those bookmark cards that's Talk Like Shakespeare Day insult generator. So... It wasn't real good. I slapped it together really fast. On the back of it, it has 3 columns, and you pick a word from each column, and that turns into a Shakespearean insult generator. So, anyway, so it's fun. It's just something to hand out. So, today, I don't really have any notes, but I just wanted to highlight again what I think is really an amazing thing that we should make ourselves aware of and then extend grace and mercy. I had mentioned when I started talking that the problem with letting the flesh run roughshod over you is that you can't keep it confined to one area. So you might think, well, you know, I'm only going to be angry at that person or unforgiving towards that person because they deserve it. I mean, I've got a friend who is absolutely convinced that Donald Trump is Satan. And so, I mean, he wouldn't say literally, but yes, that he has made the statement adamantly to me that every single word that comes out of the man's mouth is a lie. I mean, he's just adamantly made that statement to me. So, the problem is you think the flesh is going to convince you that, well, I can just have this pocket of my life where I can harbor unforgiveness and condemnation, and I can harbor, you know, whatever, envy and anger and disapproval of people. I'll just have this pocket because they deserve it. And the trouble is, you really can't. You can't just keep that pocket of your life isolated. Because what happens is it bleeds out. It bleeds out into other areas of your life, and then before you know it, there's just this raft of stuff going on in your spirit, and it's going on in the people around you, because not only does the flesh constantly bleed out into other areas of your life, but as you manifest fleshly behavior, that fleshly behavior is pinging off the people around you, and if those people aren't careful. If those people aren't careful, then their flesh riles up and that starts manifesting as well. So that buzzing that you're hearing, those are my cameras. So, you know, the cameras have, that's the camera tubes. So the cameras have seen me coming and saying registered, and they're registered for my wife that I'm coming and blah, 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 blah. So anyways, this is the difficulty of allowing the flesh to have any kind of reign over your life, that what happens is it just starts filtering into everything in your life. And as it starts filling up and filtering into everything in your life, you start experiencing these cognitive distortions, where you really need everyone else to agree with you. You need to be the ultimate authority on everything, because you're feeding on the flesh's lies to you, and those lies just get broader and deeper and more distortive of the reality that you're experiencing. And since it's all happening within the simulation that you have of reality in your head that you're living in, that whole simulation shifts. And so now you find yourself getting angry at things that you didn't get angry at before, and envious, and you find yourself lusting after things, and you find anywhere the flesh can take you next, it will take you next. And it's really fascinating to me when that happens, even though I understand it, because you see it happen over and over, and you see blindness that begins to be introduced into people and into organizations. They can't see how they're being perceived anymore because there's enough blindness. Jordan Peterson, years ago, he did an interview with a woman from the BBC. They edited the interview together such that it made him look worse and made her look better. Okay, well, that's expected. What was unexpected is they took the entire interview then and they put it up on YouTube. Because when they watched the entire interview, they saw what they had edited together. So there was no dissonance for them between all the information they had gathered in the entire interview and the 2 minutes that they put together. They thought that 2 minutes was an accurate reflection. Well, people saw the 2 minute interview and then they saw the 15 minute interview, and this woman was doing the same thing over and over. She would ask Jordan Peterson a question. He would answer in a very reasoned, methodical way, and then she'd say, "So what you're saying is," And then she would just like go off on a tangent that it didn't have anything to do with his answer. Because as she was sitting there listening to his long answer, it was basically just to her, except for the next point she wanted to have him say. And then she would say, so what you're saying is, and then that's, it's like, I don't think you just listened to what he said. You were just waiting because you knew how he was going to answer, and you just pieced in whatever you could find to piece in so that you could say, oh, so what you're saying is, and that went on and on and on in the interview. And when people saw the full interview, I mean, she was not ready. BBC was not ready for the backlash of people saying, what do you think you're doing? This is not an interview. You know, this is just a hit piece. Okay, so the fact that it was a hit piece was not amazing to me. The fact that they put the whole thing up was what was amazing to me. And you see that behavior perpetuated. So just recently, Jordan Peterson, and he's my second example and my last example of this, I have other examples. Jordan Peterson did an interview with the London Times, I think it was some Times magazine that was in England. They told the interviewer right up front, we're going to be recording the audio on this. Oh, no, that's fine. That's fine. It's no problem. No problem. So the interview goes on for, I think it was like 2 hours goes on. And the London Times had pursued Jordan Peterson. They had said, you know, we'd really like it. And he was saying, you know, I'm not really, I don't know that I'm ready. No, we do interesting stories and we tell stories that haven't been told. And, you know, we'll be very fair with you. And we just want to do an interview. You know, you've got your book coming up. So finally he agreed. His daughter was with him. And he, of course, he's coming off this tremendous physical battle that he just had with akathisia, it's called. And then the article comes out. And the, I mean, it's just a smear piece. And they specifically talked about the fact that there was one doctor that misdiagnosed him and said, oh, it sounds like you have schizophrenia, which, of course, he didn't. It was something, it was a physical malady called akathisia that was finally acknowledged. But, of course, since it's schizophrenia, quote unquote, then that's what they took and ran with it. You know, oh, well, you know, he said he doesn't have it, but that's what the doctor diagnosed him as. But this was, it's just a smear piece, including the woman who did the interview, including the fact she got just catty and nitpicky and just terse and critical of Jordan Peters' daughter to the point that she's talking about, and his daughter, you know, with all her makeup and looks like some kind of little Barbie and stuff. I mean, just, and this is supposed to be a professional reporter. And it's just startling to me, A, this professional reporter, her behavior was reduced to that. B, they put out this article even though they knew the entire conversation had been recorded. So Michaela Peterson puts out a podcast and she says, let's read the article. So she reads the section out of the article. Then she turns over and she says, here's the audio. This is what we actually said. And she just goes right down through the article and plays it. And for anyone who has not already decided that Jordan Peterson is a witch and Michaela Peterson are witches, they're all witches. For everyone who doesn't have that cognitive distortion, you listen to what's said in the article, you listen to the audio, and you go, that is not what they said. What are you doing? But it's that cognitive distortion of the flesh. It's interesting. This whole 60 Minutes story is just fascinating. Because 60 Minutes just keeps doubling and tripling down and saying, nope, we stand by the story. It was a good story. So in case you haven't heard, 60 Minutes played this little thing where they had decided, apparently, that Ron DeSantis, governor of Florida, had accepted donations from Publix, which I guess is a grocery store down there, had accepted like $100,000 for his reelection campaign. And their story was that he had then turned around and allowed them to disperse the vaccine. And so obviously this was, in their words, a pay-for-play situation. They made a donation to him, therefore he favored them in the selection in a certain city to distribute. And it's interesting because he wouldn't give them an interview, and so he was at a press conference, and one of their 60 Minutes reporters was there. So she starts off by saying, you know, Governor DeSantis, Publix has gave $100,000 to your campaign, so obviously you gave them the contract to distribute the vaccine and a pay-for-play scam. I mean, she's not even asking a question. She's making statements that are false. And Governor DeSantis says that's a false narrative. That is not what happened. It's a false narrative. You do not have your facts straight. So in the 2 minutes thing, you know, they say, well, we talked to people and they said this. And then he keeps saying, no, 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 I'm done talking to you. But there's not really an extended explanation in there because they edited it all out, except for one little piece. Well, obviously someone is there who was recording the whole exchange. So they post the whole exchange. And he goes through and he explains that Walgreens and CVS were already going into nursing homes and they were vaccinating. They were tied up with their resources. So when they were going down into Palm Beach, the CVS and the Walgreens there were already tied up going into long-term care facilities. So he said we couldn't use those. We had three different options. It was like drive-by inoculations, doctor's visits. Publix was a possibility. And he said he talked to the mayor and some city council something, both of which are Democrats. And he said, here's our options. You know, what do you guys think would work? And they said, well, you know, there's a Publix within like a mile and a half of everybody in this city. We looked it up. So we think that's pretty good. He said, so we did a test trial with Publix. He said, I went down there 3 weekends in a row. They got shots. I talked to people as they were coming out. I said, what'd you think about the experience? He said, it was 100% positive. So the mayor said, yeah, let's go with Publix. So that's what happened. And CBS, 60 Minutes, turned that into a pay-for-play narrative and doubled down on it. And when the full video got published, then CBS said, well, we routinely edit video for clarity. They couldn't see the difference between what they had produced and the full video. They could not see the difference. So the mayor of, I think it was Palm Beach, had actually contacted 60 Minutes at some point, I don't know, and had talked to them and told them, no, that's not what happened. This is a Democratic mayor. The Democratic mayor has come out and said, this is a false narrative. It's not only a false narrative, it is dead wrong. This is not what happened. And 60 Minutes just keeps going, well, we stand by our story and our integrity, and no, we don't think this has tarnished our brand at all. Okay. And then what's fascinating is all the surrounding media doesn't actually say 60 Minutes, you got this dead wrong. They said, well, you know, 60 Minutes could have done a little better. But man, this is a windfall. This is a windfall for Governor DeSantis. Isn't this great that he, well, not isn't this great, but they're really pumping this and they're going to use this because he's setting himself up politically. And this is just a gift to him. What? It's a gift to him to be misquoted and be accused of things. And we're not really going to go over to 60 Minutes and chastise them. We're just going to say, well, they could have done a little better. Maybe they shouldn't have done that. It's fascinating. It's fascinating to see the blindness that there is. The last example of this, which is just as fascinating to me, women's soccer. Women's soccer, they just did a thing where, I've lost her first name. She went, that it was International Day of the Woman, I think, and she went to the White House and they talked about unequal pay and how that they were being discriminated against because they're women. They're being discriminated against in the world soccer stuff or women's soccer league because they don't get paid as much as the men. And they got Joe Biden to stand up there and say, yeah, this is not right. The women should be paid as much as the men. And rah, 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 rah. And in fact, the women of the soccer, American soccer, had sued to get equal pay and rah, 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 rah. Okay, so... So I'm watching this guy that's reading from the judge's ruling on this because the judge threw it out in like a 32 page, 36 page. This is really long opinion. He just threw it out. And the reason he threw it out is because within men's and women's soccer, when it comes to the American soccer or something, a lot of the men play on other soccer teams. When they play for the American team, that's like just they come and do it for America, but they have salaries with other teams. Okay. So because of that, they just come in and play per game, and as far as they get is how far they get. And they get a scale that increases and increases and increases until they get, if they make it into the World Cup, I think if they make it into the World Cup and place or something, it's for whatever, they achieve a certain level, it's $400,000 is what they get per game. So that's a lot of money, but I mean, they've made it up in that upper tier. Now then, the women only get paid $100,000 if they make it up into the World Cup per game. Okay, so that's what they're talking about. That's what they're focusing on. Stumping that we deserve to get paid just as much as the men do. This is discrimination. You shouldn't discriminate against us. Okay. Except if I've got my facts correctly, and this guy I was listening to has his facts correctly, he seemed very reasoned and very calm. Except the contract that the women have was negotiated 2 years ago, and the headlines screamed about the fact that the women were very happy with this and it was good and this would help more women get into soccer because most of the soccer players on the American soccer team don't have other teams that they play for. And so they wanted a different deal. They were originally offered the deal that the men had, but they said, no, we want a guaranteed number of games, a guaranteed number of players. We want health benefits. They went down this whole list of things that they wanted. And I don't know how many of them they got, but they got a bunch. So 2 years ago, everybody was crowing about the fact how great this is that they got all this stuff. That was 2 years ago. Now, they want what the men have. Because the men get $400,000 where they only get $100,000. And that's not fair. That's discrimination. Even though this is the contract they agreed to. Now, you would think, oh, so they just want to go back to the men's contract. No, they don't. What they wanted was to maintain everything they already had that was costing the league because of the health care, because of the benefits, because of the guaranteed salaries, because of the... They want all that, plus they want what the men get for bonuses. And they didn't say, yeah, and we want this now as well. What they said was, this is discriminatory. You're discriminating against us because we're not paid the same. And they said that, and they actually believed that if someone heard the word, well, this is discrimination, that they would just go, oh, yeah, it really is. Like our dear President Joe Biden did. Oh, that's discrimination, without actually looking underneath the surface or not caring what was underneath the surface. So they actually, what in the world? We got lots of buzzing going on here. So they actually thought they could put this out there, and they sued, and they actually believed that a judge would just look at it and say, well, that's right. In this one narrow case, in just this, not looking at anything else, you're right. You do get paid differently, and that's discrimination, and you should get paid more. They apparently did not think the judge would actually look at everything. And they got their case thrown out. I mean, it's really fascinating. Because apparently they have told themselves this narrative for so long about how they've been discriminated against, they are being discriminated, that the flesh has gotten them to narrow down to where nothing else is important except this one narrow thing, and that's all they can see that. And they fully expect that everyone else is going to see it their way, and if you don't, that's just because you're evil. This is not a good way to live, friends. But guaranteed, if you let your life out, get outside the boundaries of love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control, if you let your life get outside those boundaries, guaranteed, you are going to end up in the same situation where you're going to be blinded to things. You're going to be struggling. You're going to be angry. You're going to be lustful and envious. And you're not going to understand why everyone else doesn't see it your way. And you're going to need to conclude that everyone who doesn't see it your way has some sort of a deep-seated psychological problem. This is Phil Ferrand, and I have made it home.